So our first speaker, it's really a genuine pleasure to welcome him to Santa Barbara, is Professor John Goodenough from the Mechanical Engineering and Materials Science Department at UT Austin. John started his career at Lincoln Labs after a PhD with Xena. And for those of us who are a little nervous about working on technological applications, it's very interesting that he was working on random access magnetic memory when he made the developments in concepts of cooperative ordering that we now know as the Goodenough Kanamori rules. It's maybe a lesson to all of us. Even though we kind of think of him as really one of us in the strongly correlated community, he's perhaps better known for his development of lithium cobaltite, which is now used in lithium ion rechargeable batteries, and he was awarded the Japan Prize for this in 2001. His current research focus areas are high TC, narrowband phenomena in solids, and ionic conductors, and he has very many awards and honors. He's a member of the National Academy of Engineering. And actually, this was very exciting to me when I was putting together his introduction. He has a Wikipedia entry, which is maybe a very, very great honor. So today, John is going to talk to us about magnetic properties of perovskites with d-orbital degeneracies.
Can hear? All right. First, let me acknowledge the principal author of my talk today, which is Yansha Zhou, who has made all the nice measurements and clearly is the principal author. Now, what I wanted to do, you're all familiar with the perovskite structure here, I am sure, and you're all familiar that when the basic orthorhombic distortion has to do with a cooperative rotation of the octahedra. And as one changes the rare earth ion, the R there stands for the rare earth ion, one gets a continuous change in the angle of this rotation. And yet, in many of our systems, we find midway between somewhere around gadolinium, one has a lot of very different change in properties. So I would like to point out that, or present some evidence that we have a universal octahedral site distortion in the orthorhombic materials. If there is a distortion that, where is your little arrow? There it is. Okay, that there is a, normally, if you just had a cooperative site distortion, I guess I can, you got a pointer somewhere? There we are. Then you would expect, if we take the B axis here as a rotation axis, that the B should be larger than the A and the C over the root of 2. And way back in 1977, O'Keefe and Hyde recognized that you cannot accommodate this cooperative rotation and maintain a perfect octahedron that just has to distort in order to accommodate the rotation. And there are two basic types of distortion. One has to do with changing the bond lengths. And we'll do that in terms of a Q2 and a Q3, where the Q2 has to do with an orthorhombic distortion in which you have too long, too short, and too medium bond lengths, and or a Q3, which is tetragonal, which has two short and one long. So those are somewhat degenerate, and one makes a combination of those. In addition to that distortion, the angle here that is subtended, this B axis, we'll call alpha, and that can bend and no longer be 90 degrees. It goes less than 90 degrees in a certain region, and that is going to lower the B axis. So there was a SPUTS program that was set up by Lufasa and Woodward, which assumes rigid MO6 rotations And the MO bond length average from the valence sum rule. And those calculations will compare with experiments from Maurizio back in the 70s on the iron oxide system. Right? And so here's the two types of distortions that we've already discussed. So here is measurements as a function of IR, where IR is now the ionic radius. And we've taken the ionic radius for nine-fold coordination for the rare earth ion. And it remains about 90 degrees, this alpha, and then it begins to decrease, whereas the omega, which is measuring the rotation, that is changing quite regularly all the way through. All right? So you see at around 1.11, where the alpha begins to get smaller, you see, well, here's the iron. Now the B axis is going down, whereas the prediction on the rigid rotation is that it should continue to go up. It actually is coming down because of this bending of the 90 degree angle. And you'll see that that is holding not only for iron, but for titanium. This is single crystal data, and this one here. You know, this is vanadium and chromium, gallium. Manganese has a Jahn-Teller distortion already above room temperature, so that's odd. This has high spin, low spin transition, so that's odd. And this one is also a little odd because you go through from a itinerant to localized electron transition in the nickel oxide. But you'll see this variation. You'll also notice in vanadium oxide that you come down very close to a pseudocubic system, A, B, and C over the root of 2, almost equal when you're over at lanthanum vanadium oxide. Now we look at the iron oxygen bond lengths. That just gave you evidence for the bending. And you'll see here that we've taken, I should have mentioned that this rho naught is Q2 squared plus Q3 squared, the root of that. So that's giving you the magnitude of the distortion. The magnitude of the bond length distortions is a maximum at around 1.11, where the ionic radius of the metallic system there is around 2 angstroms. It's pretty universal across the first row transition metal series. You'll see that the maximum distortion in the plane now, these distortions are in the plane to give you a long axis along a 100 and a long axis along an 010 alternating as you go from one to the other. So it's called an antiparoic distortion. So you see we have a long and a medium bond length in the basal plane. No orbital ordering in this case. No Jahn-Teller distortion. This is the intrinsic site distortion associated with a system which is high spin D5 system on the iron 3+. All right? And then when you get past here, the C-axis was getting smaller, and then as you go further on, this goes up and this crosses here. So here everything is Q3. Everything's tetragonal in the local site distortions. And you get a changeover to where you have short in the basal planes, and you have a medium along the C-axis as you get over towards lutetium. So these are the bond lengths. This is where you have a maximum in the distortions. And this is the Q2, Q3 plane. And this, here's the iron system. So we have two sites, of course. We'll just look at one. This goes along at about 150 degrees. 120 degrees would be if you had a pure tetragonal site distortion alternating along the within the basal plane. It goes up to about gadolinium. This is rho naught, these different circles. So the magnitude of the distortions are getting larger and larger till you get to about gadolinium, and then they come back and they cross over, as we saw going back, the variation of the short and the medium in the plane. Now, first, let me point out, even with iron, these things are going to make a difference. Let me go back again. Forgot to point out, this is the iron oxygen. The green ones here are simply the iron oxygen distance, mean distance. And you'll see that the mean distance is not fixed according to the valence sum rule, but it reaches a maximum at about this point. Now, let's just consider a simple problem of the nail temperature. Super exchange nail temperature goes as a B squared over U, where B is the transfer integral. And so we'll call that A of theta, which is the bending angle here, and the iron oxygen bond length. Now, for a fixed U, this A is going to go as B squared. And if this is, we do that with a fixed U, you would expect that this differential versus this would be a straight line at 45 degrees to the origin. So that's what you would predict would be the answer for a fixed U. Now, for a long time, it's been accepted that the basic change in the nail temperature was due to the bending angle, cosine theta. And if you put that in as cosine square theta, it's fine, but it qualitatively goes in the right direction, but it doesn't fit with a straight line through the origin. However, if you use the model that Walter Harrison gave many years ago, but you have to be careful because you have to not, this is cosine theta, and then you're going to go to cosine squared of omega over 2, so it's going to go as a cosine fourth omega over 2 divided by mean bond length d seventh. The b goes as cosine squared omega over 2 d to the 3.5. That was Harrison's calculation. If you interpret his stuff correctly, and you put that in and you look and see that it fits quite well. So there's no question but what the super exchange model is perfectly all right, but you have to put the right dependence here, and this shows that even though we had a fairly small change in the iron oxygen distance as you went across that system with a maximum at around gadolinium, nevertheless, because this goes as the seventh power, it makes an important difference if you want to get quantitative results as to the nail temperature. All right. Now, the next point is supposing we have an orbital degeneracy. If we have intrinsic site distortions, then they will bias the orbital ordering. So it's not a simple Jahn-Teller distortion as you would normally get, say, in a rock salt structure. In these structures, you have an intrinsic site distortion that biases the orbital ordering, and the bias is going to be to put you with long bonds on alternate ones lying in the basal plane. Now, in the case of RTiO3, there's only a single d electron. We have a threefold orbital degeneracy and octetal and cubic symmetry. And you can stabilize an A1 orbital, which will be directed along a 1-1-1 axis, or you can stabilize with the orthorhombic type distortion a YZ or a ZX. And if you stabilize the YZ or the ZX and use the normal rules for the sine of the superexchange coupling, you'll get ferromagnetism. If it's along A11, along that axis, the rules for the superexchange interactions give you anti-ferromagnetic order. All right? agenda. So what you observe, here are the variations of the bond lengths. Now this is 12-fold ionic radius, so you have to look up here to see that indeed it's a gadolinium samarium where you get the change from anti-ferromagnetic order to ferromagnetic order. Get the anti-ferromagnetic order where the 90 degree bond angle is going to less than 90 degrees, opening up a face to stabilize an electron alone in the A1 orbital. And when you get over here where you have a 90 degree angle, then in this region you get the bias and the orthorhombic distortions which give rise to the ferromagnetic coupling in the material. Well, let's go to vanadium. Vanadium, you got two electrons, but you still have an orbital degeneracy. Now, you may either get a tetragonal C over A greater than 1 for the site distortion, not for the crystallographic distortion, the site distortion. And this happens at an orbital ordering temperature which is greater than the L temperature. Or you may, because I pointed out that you're pseudocubic when you're over at LaBO3, and then you have a T naught naught, which is very close to T sub n, and one has, at this point, a big competition between spin-orbit coupling, orbital lattice coupling, and spin-spin coupling. So you have a very complex problem here associated with that competition. This shows some data, Blake and company, showing that as you cool, this is YBO3, you're well over, you see you already have the intrinsic orthorhombic site distortion as far as the bond lengths are concerned. And when you get the orbital ordering, it orders in such a way that the local site distortion is close to tetragonal C over A greater than 1. All right? So that's telling you you're quenching the orbital angular momentum when you have that site distortion. Here's another change at this temperature here. At low temperatures, you simply change of exactly the same thing in the basal planes, but you change from being in phase to out of phase as far as the directions of the orbits are concerned. So that bias, now, you know, when you take cobalt oxide, and you don't have any intrinsic site distortion to begin with, you line up collinear spins at the nail temperature, you order the spins, you order the orbits through spin-orbit coupling, and you get a distortion which is C over A less than 1 on the site, not C over A greater than 1, all right? Because you want to maximize the orbital angular momentum in that case. Here, because of the intrinsic site distortion, you are biasing the orbital ordering in such a way as to quench the orbital angular momentum. So, I think this is well known probably to most of you, simply showing that above this TCG, TN, you have the out of phase as far as the distortions are concerned, long in that direction or long in that direction. They alternate. And when you do that, by the rules of the super exchange rules, you get ferromagnetic coupling along the axis. But in the plane, the DXY is always the same, so you always have anti-ferromagnetic coupling. But when you go below, then you have these in phase, and then you form an XY, XY1, which is anti-ferromagnetic, and so you get a change from in the magnetic order. So you see, there is a gradual maximum in the orbital ordering temperature. And then as these things come down, as that is more or less pseudocubic here, well, suddenly the T naught naught and T sub n, it drops down just below, and you have this big competition at this point. Now, this is looking at the magnitude of the sight distortions. And the magnitude of the sight distortions is the maximum at around gadolinium. So if you plot that rho naught versus the T naught naught, you see it tracks very well. So it's very clear that it is the bias associated with the intrinsic sight distortion that is influencing the ordering temperature. This is all very fancy stuff. I don't have time to go into all that nice business here, but we've got time for discussion. Now, last system I would wish to talk about is manganese, the manganates. And you're all familiar with this classic Yontel-Ahr ion when it's in octahedral coordination. And we'll look at the Q2, Q3, as we've seen before. And so this is just a little cartoon showing if we had only tetragonal sight distortions, we'd have this here, and then there would be, you always have a long and a short, long and a short, long and a short. And these can be in phase or out of phase along the bound of that, but I'm not going to worry about that. Now, in this direction, you always have antiferromagnetic order. In this direction, you have ferromagnetic order due to the sigma bonding orbitals, because the sigma bonding ones are half-filled, overlapping, and empty. But the pi bonding orbitals are T3s, they're both half-filled, and therefore they're antiferromagnetic coupling. The sigma bond apparently is stronger in LAM and O3 than the pi bond. And therefore you get so-called type A antiferromagnetic order with ferromagnetic planes coupled anti-parallel to one another along the C-axis. Right? But now you see, as we put in the smaller rare earth ions, the NAL temperature is going down, indicating that the ferromagnetic term is decreasing relative to the antiferromagnetic term. These you have to prepare at high pressure, but you can prepare them in the cubic or the orthorhombic perovskite form with high pressure. And here you get this peculiar type E antiferromagnetic order, which is ferromagnetic, antiferromagnetic, ferromagnetic, antiferromagnetic, as you go along, you see one axis. And that represents, as it were, an exchange wave or an exchange density wave, right? Where you have a competition between the ferromagnetic and the antiferromagnetic interactions, and they decide to order themselves into an exchange density wave, right? So the question is, what is the term that is responsible for lowering the sigma bond interactions relative to the pi bond interactions? Well, we have three possibilities. One is the ratio of Q3 to Q2. One is the bending angle theta. And one is going to be the so-called U parameter. In this case, it's not going to be a U parameter, but it's going to be the term that comes into the super exchange interaction. All right? 10 minutes left? Oh, I've got lots of time. I've been moving too fast. Well, I see. Well, then I will just have to slow down a little bit. All right. Now, this is old data on single crystals that was done and measured when it was measured in vacuum to make sure that you weren't losing any, you know, the oxygen was not gaining oxygen. You were keeping the stoichiometry, oxygen stoichiometry. And there was this phase change a little bit at T star and then at T Yontel-Ahr. So when the Yontel-Ahr distortion comes in, bang, you get something which is not quite metallic, but which is a very good conductor. And it's clear that when you don't have orbital order, the correlation splitting between the manganese 3, manganese 2 couple is not quite big enough to overcome the bandwidth. So there's a little bit of overlap of the two Hubbard bands. All right? So that means that the energy term that's going to come into the super exchange interaction is going to be a Dalgyon-Teller. It's going to be something which goes as kT sub t, depending upon the transition temperature. So let me go back. You'll notice that the Dalgyon-Teller just ordering temperature is going up to a big maximum and around gadolinium due to the fact that the bias is getting stronger and stronger for these things as you go to that R value. All right? So, the manganese-oxygen-manganese super-exchange interaction is along the C-axis is either empty to empty for the sigma bonding and anti-ferromagnetic for the pi bonding. In the plane, as we said, it's anti-ferromagnetic for the pi bonding, ferromagnetic for the sigma bonding. And for type A magnetic order, then AL temperature would go as B squared over now A delta sigma, not U. The U is roughly what's the gap that had been made by the Dalgyon-Teller distortion. So we have to put in delta sigma equal to delta Dalgyon-Teller, which is essentially equal to a kT Dalgyon-Teller. So you now take a look at this gamma is simply a measure of the Q3 to Q2 component. And if we look very carefully on the slides a little earlier, it so happens that it goes more tetragonal, not less tetragonal, the site distortion in the manganese oxide as you go towards gadolinium. So that has the wrong sign. This cosine fourth omega over T, which is omega over two, this term, which is what people always have cited for why the transition is going down, counts for 0.8 out of 9 for the magnitude. Whereas this term gives you 7 out of 9. So the principal contribution to the reduction in the sigma bond component is due to the fact that we're increasing the splitting between the upper and the lower Hubbard band as we increase the bias on the Dalgyon-Teller distortion. All right? And that increases this term delta sigma that comes in to lower the strength of the magnetic interaction with the sigma bonding orbitals. And that is why we have the major contribution. And so here we see this was the nail temperature coming down, and then the type E. This is the contribution due to the bending. It follows right qualitatively, but quantitatively is too small. And this is variation due to the change in the temperature of the Dalgyon-Teller distortion. So that's as far as I wanted to go. The rest is for discussion. Let me say that I had on my original slide had something to do with the ruthenates. Now, some of you may have some interest in the ruthenates. And if you want, I'll take a few minutes to talk about the ruthenates. Some people are nodding their heads. Geez, little chairman, 5 minutes to do ruthenates. All right, well. This system was an itinerant electron ferromagnet. Temperature is 164K, 1.4 magnitude at 5K, not 2. A little bit reduced, but the mu effective is very close to the spin-only value of 2.8. And when you put in K calcium for strontium, you get a lowering of the Weiss constant theta, and it becomes less than T sub C. It goes negative at about x equals 0.8. And I know when we first looked at this system, back then, I don't know when, I'll tell you how many years ago, I assumed it had gone antiparamagnetic, but we sent our sample of CARUO3 down to Gen Shirani in Brookhaven to look at it with Mossbauer. He said, no magnetic order in CARUO3. So, that's the situation, but there's an incipient ferromagnetic order because you put a little titanium into it and it goes back ferromagnetic in CARUO3. So, in the old days, we could put pressure on BARUO3 and we could get as far as going from the 9R polytype to the 6H polytype, and to the 4H polytype, 6H polytype, but we couldn't get all the way to cubic. Recently, in Japan, we succeeded with 18 gigapascals to at 1100 degrees to stabilize cubic BARUO3. And that is a ferromagnet. It's metallic, with a Curie temperature about 80 K, and it's down from 140 K. The moment is down from 0.8. So as you go cubic and you stretch the bond a little bit, because the barium is a little bit larger, you have a classic itinerant electron ferromagnetism in which the U value is getting a little bit smaller. Now, if you look at the 9R, 4H, 6H, 3C, and you're looking at the inverse paramagnetic susceptibility, you'll see this is classic for a ferromagnet. But this is not, and CARUO3 is more like this one. And this is due to the fact that the ruthenium 4 plus, when localized, has J equals 0. At low temperature. As you increase the temperature, you excite the moments. Now you take a look and you see, okay, strontium, barium, the barium, you put in more strontium and the Curie temperature increases, but always, as with strontium, you have a perfectly good ferromagnetic material, classical situation. As soon as you start to put in calcium, theta is going down faster than T sub C. And you're getting a bending over of the susceptibility, which is classic of a Griffiths phase, in which you're breaking up, you're introducing a certain number of dead sites in there where you cannot get the coupling, magnetic coupling. So, what's happening, I believe, is 1 minute left. Good, my last slide. What we have is a transition from itinerant electron ferromagnetism. As I put in the calcium, which is going to make it, it's more acidic and should make it a narrower band, and therefore should increase, if we continue, increase the Curie temperature. No, it kills the Curie temperature in the neighborhood of the calcium because you localize it enough for the spin orbit coupling to then come in and give you ruthenium with J equals zero. And those have no magnetic coupling between them. And as a result, you get this Griffiths phase. It fits, there's the Griffiths prediction very nicely there if you use a Heisenberg model. And I think that I'm done, and that is the story on the ruthenates, and I think it helps to resolve this problem where you are close to the itinerant to localized electron behavior. We know that that's a first order transition. We know that one can get some phase separation between regions which have localized or more localized electrons and regions that have more itinerant electrons.
So we have plenty of time for discussion and questions. Igor? Oh, and we need to use the microphones for the questions because this is being recorded.
Okay, so I'm very intrigued about this new ruthenite that you, I didn't know about this barium-based material. And I want to...
You don't know about it because they won't allow us to publish it, they say.
Okay.
It's all known, you see. They don't seem to pay attention to the facility, and so the referees won't let us publish it.
Well, I'm, but in this connection, that brings up to my mind that 11 years ago, David Singh and I did calculations for, and without any attempt to account for any localization or any correlations, just pure LDA calculations for the series of cubic, quasi-cubic ruthenates, covering the whole range of rotation from zero, which correspond to this newly discovered barium, to strontium, to calcium, and our results exactly, precisely correspond to what you just told. We found that at zero rotation, we have reduced tendency to magnetism and equilibrium moment, if I'm not mistaken, about 0.8, and then it raises to strontium, and has maximum at the angular rotation corresponding to strontium, without changing the filling itself, just pure rotation. And then it goes down, and stoner factor just drops exactly to zero, precisely at the rotation corresponding to calcium. And that's only just pure effect of density of states and combination of, you know, just changing shape of density of states and no fancy effects.
One thing that in a calculation like that, you have to be careful about. First of all, I'm sure your calculation is probably very good, and what I didn't mention is the barium being more very basic, even though it stretches the bond, it broadens the bandwidth. Calcium being more acidic, and also bending the bond, but the acidic character of the calcium is what makes the interaction, because that's in competition with the pi bond interaction, and these are low spin materials. You have to take into account the fact that at the crossover from itinerant to localized electron behavior, you're going to get segregation, as it were, between regions which are still band-like and regions which are localized, right. The calcium ruthenium oxide I didn't mention is a metal, even though it doesn't give the order. There's enough breakup and enough of this business of the J equals zero states to be able to kill it. Now, there have been NMR measurements and some other measurements that have also indicated that one has ferromagnetic clusters and non-magnetic regions within the calcium ruthenium oxide system. So, in your calculations, whenever you're looking at this transition, be careful when you go across from localized to itinerant behavior that you're not going to miss first-order phase change.
So that's you. So you're not you're not disturbed by the fact that calculations which do not take into account the difference in acidity or localization reproduce experiments precisely and in all aspects.
Well, I think it's very nice. I'm very happy for your calculations, but I am also saying that from a chemistry point of view, you wonder why the bandwidth is getting broader when you're stretching the ruthenium oxygen bond. Because you're almost cubic in strontium ruthenium oxide, you go to barium ruthenium oxide. The reason you cannot make it except under pressure is because you have to squeeze it and then take the pressure off. And the barium is now stretching that ruthenium oxygen bond a little bit. Why? Why should the bandwidth get broader?
Well, I think that's why, because I'm getting
this. Yeah, well, it's fine. Your calculation is fine. You can say what you like about the calculation. I'm only telling you from a more chemical point of view what I think is causing the broadening of that band, all right, with the barium. And I'm also cautioning you that whenever you go from localized to itinerant electron behavior, we get the first order phase change, and that's why you have all these quantum critical points and all these funny differences.
I'd like to ask a short follow-up question based on your comment on the chemistry of the A site, which is when you were showing the trends across the rare earths, yttrium was always fitting in just exactly where you'd expect for its size. And can you comment on any circumstances where yttrium...
Well, it's almost the same for its size, but not quite. But it's basically the size and the degree of the rotation. Now, what happens is that the degree of rotation and the size is going to determine the local site distortion, which is accommodating the rotation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it fits in quite well, because the size is important.
And that's always more important than the difference in chemistry between yttrium and...
Well, that particular... The chemistry does make some difference, mm-hmm. but not such a great deal of difference. But when you're dealing with these barium, strontium, and calcium ones, you do have to worry about...
It's a much bigger effect.
And the big surprise was, when you have strontium and ruthenium oxide and you put in an ion which gives you a bigger angle and is more acidic, why doesn't it narrow the band and therefore cause your itinerary electron model to have to continue to increase? Instead, it introduces a Griffith phase, regions where J goes to zero. And that can only happen because thin orbit coupling gives you J equals zero states on the ruthenium 4 plus.
You have another question over here, and I think Daniel was next.
My name is Hao Cheng from University of Cologne. I'm very happy with your remark that ruthenium 4 plus tends to be J0 if it's localized. Actually, as we found all the time when we do calculations, as you know, we're working on ruthenates, 214 systems. We're looking at also the metamagnetism occurring at let's say, strontium 0.2 concentrations. And whenever you do localized calculations, the J0 state is always the most stable, and we have to really work hard to get rid of that. And so I'm very happy that this J0 is really, you know, probably very general, and that you need the band formation to kill it. So is that correct way of stating?
Well, thank you. I'm happy you're happy with that.
Yeah, Daniel Chomsky. In connection with this Vanadate, you are very well familiar with this problem that you also have this in your phase diagram, this yellow part. And you said that you can comment on what's going on in systems like yttrium vanadate or lanthanum vanadate, especially in yttrium vanadate, when there is a change of magnetic and orbital structure, in which each time susceptibility or magnetic moment change sign from positive to negative or from negative to positive. That's yttrium vanadate is the most clear example. And the first diamagnetic behavior, I think that we more or less understand. But I must say that as to the second change of sign at around 70 Kelvin or 77 in yttrium vanadate, I really don't understand what it is. I just wonder, maybe you can comment on that. What, in your opinion, is going on in magnetic structure at the second transition in yttrium vanadate?
What our friend Danielle is asking, where have I got my point going, is this is dysprosium, but here we're over it, we're here. And you go through this transition here, and when you're in this orbital ordering, which is G-type orbital ordering and C-type spin ordering, as you lower the temperature, you change from the susceptibility being positive, paramagnetic, to becoming diamagnetic, because there is a competition, as he pointed out, whether which is the stronger, what temperature is a matter of debate, but the fact is there is a Jalozinski term which is giving you a spin canting to give you a weak ferromagnetic moment, and there is also an anisotropy term which turns out to be in the opposite direction, which gives you a change of the spin. Then he says, why, when you go through here, you suddenly flip back the other way?
Exactly.
It's because the anisotropy term in that phase is quite different, I believe. that the one I want? Did I go too far? Oh, what am I wearing? Oh, sorry, going the wrong way. You see, here you have the anisotropy term, which has been turned those things in the direction of an axis. Here you already have a term which bends it this way due to the orbital, due to the rotation, because the spins are now along the C axis. And the Jalozinski term is still giving the Jalozinski vector changes sign when you change the magnetic order. And that gives you an fx, and this gives you an fx. And they both go in the same direction in that phase, whereas in the other phase, they compete against each other. I believe that's the answer.
I have to digest it still. Okay, good.
Yes, Paolo Rodelli from ISIS. I'd like to go back to the issue of structural bias upon orbital ordering, because that's, I think it's an important point that I would like to understand better. So you're saying, essentially, even in systems that have no orbital degree of freedom, such as the iron case, yeah. Iron 2+, you have a bias, you have a structural distortion which involves the Q2 and Q3 modes, and also the bending of...
No, I don't do the Q2, Q3, look, they're there, that's correct. They're there, that's intrinsic to the site, the Q2, Q3 modes, that's correct.
But why is the, but my question is the following. First of all, what is the driving force for this? Because it could distort the structure without having any Q2, Q3 modes. You could have perfect cubic octahedra and just rotating them. You could accommodate the structure like that.
No, fortunately, as was pointed out by O'Keefe and Hyde, it cannot accommodate a simple rotation, single rotation axis. You have a single rotation axis, apparently you have to have a site distortion to accommodate the rotation. And this, so one doesn't go smoothly, for example, from the orthorhombic phase to the cubic phase. One always goes through a tetragonal phase or a rhombic eagle phase or something.
Yeah. Okay. I don't understand this. Geometrically, you can, and I don't know why in practice that doesn't happen.
So it's a geometrical problem as to why one has to have some kind of a site.
And the second question
associated with that rotation. Yeah.
And the second question is that these distortions away from perfect octahedra, if you want, they are rather small compared to the ones that you introduce when you really orbital ordering. So why should that matter? You know, when you have this very big distortion upon orbital ordering, why should that be biased?
Well, now wait. Of course. When you have orbital order, you're going to enhance the distortion, right? But when you have no orbital ordering, it's relatively small, but it's enough so that it biases, because you're not starting. I mean, there's a very delicate balance between the sign of the distortion you're going to get when you have cubic symmetry, whether you are going to get a Yonteller distortion that's quenched the orbital angular momentum, or you're going to get a distortion which enhanced the orbital angular momentum. And normally, say in cobalt oxide or iron oxide, when you cool through the nail temperature and get a cooperative ordering of the spins, that gives you cooperative ordering of the orbits. Right? In this particular case, the collinear spins, you have a cooperative ordering with spin orbit coupling, then it would go against this internal site symmetry bias. So even though it is small, it still steers the big distortion.
I think we could. I'd like to continue this discussion at the break also, because I'm having trouble visualizing why these distortions, why the rotations lead to these Q2 and Q3 distortions too. Let's thank Professor Goodenough again. We have to move on to the next speaker.
Thank you, Christina.
So our next speaker is David.